Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked to the 12th canto of Purgatorio. We are on the Terrace of Pride after the main gate of Purgatorio. We are way along in Dante's masterwork comedy. We're going to be at the first 12 lines of Purgatorio. 12, this is my English translation. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. And I admit up front that this is a small passage. It's small because Purgatorio Canto 12 is packed and so difficult. There is no use in making the passages long because then the episodes of Walking with Dante get interminable. So we're going to take it slowly. Just the first 12 lines of Purgatorio, Canto 12. Paired up as bulls go along under a yoke, that belabored soul and I walked on, at least as long as my sweet tutor permitted it. But then Virgil said, "Let him be and get going, because it's only right to speed your ship with wings and with oars as much as you can." I stood up, spine straightened, as a person should be, even though my thoughts remained both bent over and emptied out. So I started off, willingly following in my master's footsteps. With our every movement, we passed on in a way that showed we were more fleet-footed. That's the passage, and it includes some really wild back references. It refers back even to Inferno, and it's got a couple of very odd medieval Florentine problems in it that we want to talk through. And one possible mistake. To get there, I want to go back and talk about how I think in the last episode of the podcast, I actually may have made a mistake given my thesis, and then move on into the problems of these 12 lines. In the last episode of the podcast, we talked about Provençan Salvani, and Orisi had brought him up as walking under another boulder, or crushed down and walking under another boulder next to Orisi. And I said that one of the big questions is, why does Dante damn Farinata and save Salvani? Listen, I've read this in a million places, and of course, it is just a trope in criticism. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, wait a minute, I'm violating my own thesis that comedy is a poem in process. A poem in process because Dante is writing it over so many years. A poem in process because ink and quills and parchment and vellum and all of that are very expensive in Dante's day. Revision is not what it is now. And because you have to then actually posit for that to be a problem in comedy, that Dante had the whole thing worked out from the beginning. That is, he was setting this trap somehow early on. But what if over the course of writing comedy, Dante's thoughts have changed? And what if now, years into the composition of comedy, he came across Farinata again? Would he still put Farinata in Inferno? And the answer is, I don't know, and also no one could ever know. But maybe this indicates a change in Dante, a change over the course of the poem. That is, his attitude toward Florence is changing. His attitude toward his own political landscape is changing. Now that he is safer while writing Purgatorio, we presume, under the tutelage and patronage of various warlords, perhaps now his attitude toward Florence itself has changed, and he's a little more sympathetic to this Salvani fellow who was so drastic in his condemnation of Florence, wanting to raise it to the ground. My thesis that comedy is a poem in process, I think, leads us back to Occam's razor. The simplest answer is the easiest one. Now, I know, many a person has slit their throat on Occam's razor, and it doesn't always work out, to say the least. But if we think about that poem and its length of composition and the expense of its composition, then we might think that Dante is free over the course of several years to begin to change his mind about how judgment would happen on those back here in the terrestrial sphere. That's my little mistake predicated on my reading, just too much criticism. All right, enough with that. And Provençal Salvani and Odorici, who comes up in the opening lines of this passage, and on to it. And we're going to just take it three lines at a time, tercet by tercet, because this is a tough one. Starting off, paired up as bulls go along under a yoke, that belabored soul, that is Odorici, and I walked on, at least as long as my sweet tutor permitted it. Now, let me just stop and say there's one little niggle here. That is the assumption that that belabored soul is Odorici. It could be Provençal Salvani. It's doubtful because Provençal Salvani never speaks, and Odorici ends the speech in the last canto with the prediction of Dante's exile. It's most likely a reference to Odorici, but it is a little gray. Is that intentional? I don't know. Is it intentional because we can't really see these fellows under their rocks? Maybe. It seems to me that it just might be an easier explanation to say it's Odorici. Although I have to say, it's not 100% of a certain identification. But what is that problem of the bulls? If you remember, Dante is bent over. He's bent over further and further as he's been walking along so he can see these guys under these boulders. And now he's paired up, as it says, as bulls go along under a yoke. This is a reference back to Uzza. Remember we had Uzza back in that intaglio of David dancing in front of the Ark of the Covenant. And Uzza was the guy that reached out and tried to steady the Ark, and then Uzza was struck dead because essentially the answer is God doesn't need any help. And Uzza thought he was helping out God by steadying the Ark of the Covenant. Back then, when we had Uzza in that intaglio, the idea was that Uzza was doing something that he wasn't officially commissioned to do. So now we have a reference to that again, to bulls pulling something. And we have a secondary reference here that may or may not be playing around, and it's extra textual. Dante has a letter. It could be a forgery, or it could be Dante's letter. This is a bit of a scholarly debate, but for the moment, let's assume that Dante's letter to the cardinals of the Italian peninsula is actually from our poet. In that letter, Dante tries to explain that he is not heretical or presumptuous by writing comedy. And one of the things he brings up in that letter is Uzza and steadying that cart. And what Dante says in the letter is, I'm not Uzza because I'm focused on the oxen going along and not on the ark. That's some hair splitting for you right there. I'm focusing on how the cart is pulled, not what's in the cart. That is disingenuous, to say the least, since we have 100 cantos about what's in the cart. We have 100 cantos about essentially the journey to the presence of God and the journey to the actual divine vision at the end of Paradiso. Come on, Dante, don't split hairs quite like that. But he's trying to. He's trying to say what my poem does is it just focuses on the oxen. I'm sorry to laugh because it's so crazy. I'm just focused on how the cart is pulled, not what's in the cart. In this passage, again, we have this weird reference back to Canto 10, to that intaglio, to oxen. That's the last time we saw oxen in the poem. And here, Dante is like the oxen. And we would have to say that Dante is trying to tell us by this back reference to something in Canto 10 that he is what pulls the cart. Something that, you know, he's not steadying the cart. He's not helping God out here. He's, in fact, pulling the cart along with Odorici like good oxen. But we know that that is a little disingenuous, even in this passage, as a back reference to that intaglio. We know that what Dante wants us to know is that he's humbled on the terrace of pride. But we know, and will continue to know even more in Canto 12, that Dante is far from humbled. One other thing in this opening tercet. He says that they walked along as long as my sweet tutor permitted it. pedagogo. This word is, what's called a hepex legomenon. That is a one-time use of a word. Dante scholars pay a lot of attention to the hepexes or hepexes in the poem because they seem to say that Dante only uses this word once. And so why hasn't he used it elsewhere? And is he using it to call attention to it by only using it once in the poem? That may be a little bit turgid, a little bit overstated as a rationale, but it is interesting that the word pedagogo comes up here, pedagogue. Is there something about Virgil that Dante has to rely on? In other words, having imagined God's art and having imagined it as this gorgeous art that is realer than real, we'll deal a lot more with this in the next episode of the podcast, now Dante needs a way that he is reined in, and part of the way he's reined in or made just a bull pulling the cart is by making sure we understand that the real teacher here is not Dante, but Virgil. Pedagogo, tutor, teacher, the pedagogue, that role for Virgil becomes very important in order to absolve Dante of pride, which he could be definitely guilty of, given his imagination of God's realm, the afterlife. Going on to the second tercet. Virgil said, "Leave him be and get going, because it's only right to speed your ship with wings and with oars as much as you can." Now, here the pedagogo, the pedagogue, the tutor, really goes nuts, because this is a reference, a direct reference, back to Ulysses. In Inferno, Canto 26, line 25, Ulysses says, "We turned our oars into wings as we flew across the world on this damned mission to see Mount Purgatory across the world." Well, actually to travel across the world, but we happened to land up at Mount Purgatory, which led to our doom. Ulysses sitting here, that can't be a mistake, right? First of all, it's in Virgil's mouth. So Virgil, the pedagogue, the tutor, is kind of referring to Ulysses, but not negatively. Virgil is saying, go on, be Ulysses, turn your oars into wings, sail on, get going with the big journey, the Ulyssian journey. It's so odd that in Purgatorio, Ulysses sits right back here. Remember all those references in Ante-Purgatory to Ulysses? And now we have another one, but this one's in Virgil's mouth, as if somehow it's okay to go on because the pedagogue sanctions the Ulyssian search for the unknown. And then it gets harder. I stood up. Okay, fine. So I'm bent over. I'm like those bulls pulling that cart that Uzzah gets killed for touching. I'm like one of those bulls. Virgil says, hey, be more like Ulysses. Speed on into the unknown. I stood up, spine straight, and as a person should be. Notice the reference here to as a person should be. Notice the wild way this kind of refers to straightening back up into a mortal form. I think that's really important that we're being told, essentially, that Dante is corporeal here. He's not one of these spirits, although he may have been momentarily acting like them. Even though my thoughts, the passage goes on, remain both bent over and emptied out, as I translate it, skemi. This is a very strange word, and this has troubled many a Dante scholar. A lot of people connect this back to that tumor. Remember, Dante says there's a great swelling or a great tumor that has been lanced in me by Odorici's speech. And so since the cyst or the tumor has been lanced or opened up, this is the emptying. It's now out of fluid. And I think that's certainly what Dante wants us to think. However, it's very hard to hear a word like schemi, emptying out, deflating, losing inner substance, and not think of the kenosis of the second person of the Trinity, Jesus. The notion comes from St. Paul that when Jesus descends out of the Godhead or out of heaven and comes to earth, he empties out the divine attributes in order to become the Son of God. He's no longer omnipresent. He limits himself to this sphere, and we have this kenosis, this emptying out, that's sitting perhaps behind this word, and it makes Dante even more prideful because you're suddenly linking yourself to something that happened to the second person of the Trinity. Or here's probably the way I see it. It's not so much the lancing, although that's what Dante wants us to see, the lancing of the tumor. I think the kenosis reference is a little bit of a stretch. What I think this is false modesty. I think Dante wants us to see that, oh, hey, you know, I have now become very humbled here on the Terrace of Pride, and this former tumor has been lanced. But given what's about to head into our faces right ahead of us in Canto 12, and what already headed at us in Canto 10 with those intaglios, and also the complete imagination, the unbelievable imagination of Umberto and Odorizzi's speeches, which didn't actually happen. This emptying out rings a little, well, shall we say, hollow. Dante wants that metaphor, so let's just give it to him. It seems a little hollow. So I started off, the passage ends, willingly following in my master's footsteps with our very movement we passed on in a way that showed we were more fleet-footed. And this is the problem in the passage and maybe the mistake. With our very movement we passed on in a way that showed we were more fleet-footed, is Virgil more fleet-footed? Has Virgil lightened up on the Terrace of Pride? I don't think so. I think that this is a little bit funky. Virgil, as a spirit, would have been light all along. Dante has been lightened because he's been enlightened about pride, and Dante wants us to see that this heaviness of pride, think of the rocks, this heaviness has been lifted off of him. But in so doing, there's a little bit of a gaffe here. Virgil can't have become more fleet-footed. He's always been fleet-footed as a spirit, and his movements can't show in any way that he has been absolved of pride. He is, after all, damned and beyond absolving. So it's a little bit strange. It's a little bit torqued. I can't, in my interpretation of the passage, help but think it's torqued because Dante's torqued. I mean, this is the rationale. Dante wants us to believe that he's been humbled, but the poem itself is so magnificent, so fully imagined, and so much a part of speaking the action of God and the judgment of God into this world that the poem itself is a prideful act. So given all of that, it seems that Dante is in a tight place, and it wouldn't strike me as odd from any writer, from George Eliot, from Strindberg, from Ibsen. It wouldn't strike me odd that at this moment their prose would torque a little, or their diction would torque a little, because they're in a tight spot as a writer that they can't necessarily see their way out of. I think that may be happening here, although you can impugn me here for overreading. But the hour is just troubling. It doesn't quite make sense. Are you saying that Virgil got lightened up on this Terrace? No, that can't have happened. We all know that can't have happened. Is Dante becoming more like Virgil? Well, I hope not. Virgil's damned. So in what way are they both more fleet-footed if Virgil has been so all along? In what way do their steps together indicate something? All very interesting and part of the unbelievable complexity that is about to set in on the Terrace of Pride. I'm not going to read this passage again. I'm going to save it for the next episode and read it then. But for now, let's just say that the Terrace of Pride, especially in Canto 12, is going to become very difficult, and we're going to have to kind of slow up. So next time, I'll read this passage connected with the next 12 lines, because they do form one solid sweep before we hit the art in the 12th Canto of Purgatorio. To get there, you got to subscribe to this podcast, rate it, like it, do those things. If you don't mind, I really appreciate it. And otherwise, I will see you back here next time for the rest of this introductory 24 lines that open Canto 12. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I'll see you soon.